Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration. Collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next guest on Face to Face is Brett Gaylor. He's a returning guest, but also a returning filmmaker. He's a producer, he's a director, writer, and a creative voice, it seems to me, talking about things that not everyone is willing to peel the layers back on. His new film, Discriminator, you can not only find out more about it, but you can watch it, actually, discriminator.film. And it's 15 minutes long, and it's going to be 15 minutes well spent. We talk about facial recognition software and facial recognition databases. We talk about something called machine learning and something the remix culture. How's that? Creativity as serendipitous, and the 100 million database make a face challenge. What are these things called, data sets, and how do they affect human rights and digital ethics, and where do laws and guidelines and where do these rules kind of cross over and maybe kind of fall apart around us? We talk about the uses for some of this technology that we really at this point in time can't even imagine, and that the stuff of science fiction. We talk about how the context has shifted and the unlawful use of technology. The quantification of humans is something that comes up as well, and of course the pros and the cons and so on. We talk about automated decision making, and I had just such a great time with Brett, and I think you're gonna love the conversation and the interview. I hope you love the interview, but the film is really, it's fascinating, it's interesting, it's entertaining, and you kind of, it's one of those pieces where you step back at doc film and you say, wow, if even just some of this is true, boy, are we in deep trouble. We talk about the legislative solutions to this, and what does it mean for privacy, and something really cool that I think other filmmakers and artists will appreciate, the form in the narrative. You can find out more about Brett Gaylor, that's GAYLOR.com, also impostormedia.com, more about what Brett is up to. But the film is Discriminator, as it's, I was going to say as it sounds, Discriminator as it's spelled, I suppose, dot F-I-L-M, F-I-L-M.film. So check it out. Coming right up, Brett Gaylor in seconds, I think. But don't forget, davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing, my public speaking, and also my podcasting. You can find all of the episodes of a Face-to-Face Live there. And, you know, pretty excited about what's coming up around the corner, the Toronto International Film Festival. Hybrid model this year, about 100 films, and I'm not going to be interviewing all those filmmakers and directors, but I am going to be digging in with a few of them, already looking pretty interesting. And that's up and coming around the corner. And if you are enjoying what's happening here on Face to Face and you listen on a regular basis, please take a little bit of time. It's so appreciated. And leave a review for us. There's actually a link on my site that will get you there pretty quickly. You can do that on iTunes. We'd so appreciate that. Like us on YouTube, subscribe to the YouTube channel. Those kinds of things go a long way. And of course, sign up for the newsletter. We only send out about 5 or 6 of those a year. And, you know, socially mediate us, share it with family and friends. Again, we'd really appreciate that. Getting word on the street is, getting word on the digital street is wow, it's just so important to you know, getting out there, as it were. So especially in this COVID-like era we find ourselves in. So davidpecklive.com, check it out there. And Brett Gaylor coming right up. Fascinating conversation. We had a lot of fun too. And the film is called Discriminator. Check it out, discriminator.film. But stay tuned for my interview on Face to Face with Brett Gaylor coming right up. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a returning special guest. We've got Brett Gaylor here with us today, calling in from the West Coast, I believe. Brett, thanks for joining us here today on Face to Face.
Thanks, David. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Nice to have you back. The Internet of Everything. So really quickly, what's changed since our last conversation? And by the way, folks, the film we're talking about, though, is Discriminator, discriminator.film, brettgaylor.com, and impostermedia.com. So you got your homework cut out for you if you're listening in, but do check out Brett's work. And we chatted about, Brett, is it about a year ago now?
Yeah, I released The Internet of Everything.
Yeah, March, tell us a little bit about that.
March 2020, so not much was going on in March 2020. Slow news year. I guess my sarcasm isn't translating.
That's right.
The algorithm is not picking it up.
Yeah, the algorithm's just not working today, clearly, Brett.
Yeah. It was about ubiquitous computing and the internet sort of moving off of screens and into all of our devices, you know, the Internet of Things. So we call it the Internet of Everything. And we released it during a pandemic on CBC, which was actually not a bad, it was interesting because it was like this week where everybody couldn't leave their house and was on the internet 24/7. So a documentary about the internet and how it was sort of ubiquitous and needed to be thought of more like, you know, electricity or water or just things that we need in order to sort of operate the society that we've built. So that was resonant. It was a film that was also concerned about some of the things that were happening around about the internet in terms of, you know, centralization and the big platforms and the sort of privacy implications, the things like that. And those also became quite a bit more present and obvious for people, you know, like when you completely depend on something for all of your information and going to school and, you know, going to the doctor and educating your kids, you realize like, maybe that should be thought of as a public resource and not something that, you know, that a company can sort of capriciously change the rules on overnight. So that was Internet of Everything was a couple of years in the making. And then like everybody else, I went into my basement and with my family and sort of hunkered down. And then Discriminator came along, which is a film about facial recognition databases. So I discovered that these photos that I had uploaded years ago, like almost 10 years ago, had been gathered up into these very large facial recognition databases. So they were included in these collections of photos that computer science researchers were using to train artificial intelligence systems to how to recognize a human face. So, you know, just like all artificial intelligence or just like all machine learning systems, to be more specific, you know, they learn to pick up a pattern. So you show it a bunch of data and then it figures out the similarities between that data. Sorry, I'm like about to like completely just do the movie in front of you right now.
No one's gonna have to watch the movie, Brett.
Yeah, I'll just stop.
Can you get us to the 3-minute mark and then maybe we can get back to the interview? Does that work?
Sure.
Maybe, hey, I think the sarcastic algorithm is kicked back in for some reason.
There you go.
So just before we shift, I mean, that's great. And it was so interesting. It's fascinating. I mean, ubiquitous for sure. I want to talk about that. Machine learning, what pray tell does that even mean, you know? But hey, where can people see Internet of Everything before we step into this bigger conversation about your new film?
Yeah, it is, if you are in Canada, it's on CBC Gem. You can watch it for free on Gem. Cool. And if you are in the US, it's on Amazon Prime. And everywhere else in the world is probably a different story, depending on... It actually sold pretty well, so you could probably turn on TV at the right time and watch it, or on YouTube. I think it was it's available in some countries on YouTube.
Cool. Okay. Well, that's excellent. So clearly, the Internet of Everything is working out for you.
Yeah, it was in some ways, it's a similar film to Discriminator.
Right. That right. It's a similar themes.
Yeah. I had made a film in 2008 called Remix Manifesto. That was kind of a celebration of what was going on in the internet at that time. And then, with Do Not Track in 2015, sort of having a second look at the systems that we built. And then, you know, since 2019 or so, I've been trying to process living in the dystopia that we've created online.
Right. Yeah, no, for sure. So by the way, congratulations on the film. Really loved it. It's, by the way, folks, it's 15 minutes long. It's super interactive in an almost creepy kind of V for Vendetta way. But you got to check it out. And again, discriminator.film is where you can see this. Brett, I think it's really interesting that just yesterday I read an article about, here's the headline, private moments captured on home security cameras being live streamed again on website. I think it's just remarkable that the day after I read this article, you and I are talking essentially about ubiquity, I suppose, media, facial recognition, and frankly, privacy. Can you kind of, I mean, it's only a 15-minute film, but can you unpack a little bit of that for us? And then I want to talk about Noam Chomsky, Darren Aronofsky, and manufacturing consent, but that's going to maybe need to be a second podcast. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so basically in Discriminator, as I was mentioning earlier, it kind of charts how I discovered how these photos were used. And so in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, people were just starting to get used to uploading their private moments to the internet. And so Flickr was right. Actually one of the first social networks, the photo sharing site. And I was a big user of that site. You know, you had your digital camera, which was kind of new. You would go right. out, you would take pictures with your friends or your family, and you would upload those to share them, right? So that they could, you view your photos without being in the same room as you. It was kind of a big deal, and it still is amazing, and though we take it for granted. And the other thing that Flickr allowed you to do was to put what's called a Creative Commons license on that photo. And so that means that other people can download that photo, and they can also use that photo for a use that you didn't anticipate. Right. And that was also kind of something at the time that was thought of as a way to kind of build a new public domain that didn't have a lot of the rules of the past, the way that copyright was being protected for big movies and songs. Right. And that was sort of getting in the way of this remix culture that was, you know, being celebrated by myself and others at that time. So the idea was, you know, let's build something new where we're kind of, you know, being sort of radically open and we're sharing. And, you know, what I thought would happen with those photos would somebody would like, oh, you know, I had taken a photo of this building and they wanted to talk about this building in their podcast or their, you know, their blog. And so they could use my photo without asking permission, or they'd make a collage, or who knew, right? Like, that was the whole idea.
Yeah, no,
like,
for sure.
Who knows what's going to happen? The creativity is like that. It's very serendipitous. But what also happened was that Flickr was purchased by Yahoo, and then Yahoo built a sort of department of computer scientists who realized that all these photos that had been uploaded in this fashion were solving this problem that computer science researchers were beginning to encounter, which was that they couldn't train computers to recognize images in the way that they wanted because there wasn't enough images that they could get a hold of. You need, you know, millions of images to be able to get a computer to have the accuracy that's required for one of these computer vision systems. And so, you know, it's a really practical problem if you're this computer science researcher, because, you know, I can't pay for all those images. That would make me bankrupt. I can't ask a million people if I can use their photo. It's just practically impossible. What if there was this library that had been created by people who were uploading these photos and who had sort of already said that you can do whatever you want with them? And so Flickr created what was called the YFCC 100M, which is the Yahoo Flickr Creative Commons 100 million database, which was, and I think still is, the largest collection of images ever.
That's a lot of photos.
It is. 100 million is a lot of photos, right? And so if you're a computer scientist and you want to say, like, hey, I want to teach a computer to recognize a bird, or I want to, you know, recognize a house or a car or whatever, it's perfect, right? You just, and they even, I think they even annotated all these photos. And so that was going on. I had no idea that was going on. At the same time, the University of Washington took that entire 100 million photos, and then they made a subset of that database that was just faces, and right. That was called Megaface,
right?
Which is like a really original and amazing name, guys. Like, I just, kudos to you. And so that database was placed online, and they let basically anybody that wanted download these faces. I think it was like 5 million faces, and the idea was that they would run a contest to see who could build the best system for recognizing faces. And so, like, Google got in on it. All the companies that you'd be familiar with, like the Facebook, Google, Microsoft,
sure.
All of them did it. But then all these other companies that you've never heard of, that you've heard of now, like Huawei and Tencent and ByteDance, who make TikTok, Clearview AI that the RCMP recently, were found to have used illegally here in Canada. All these companies downloaded this database to solve that problem that I just mentioned. They're like, oh, perfect. This will allow us to build facial recognition systems.
So Brett, so is your, and I don't even know if this is right. I was going to say, is your beef with the computer scientists, would you say? I mean, it's just interesting because you just kind of present this for us to see. It's new information for sure. I learned quite a bit from Discriminator, which I think is amazing. And so many of us just, I don't know, gleefully accept some of these forms that we give permission to, the things we consent to. So I'm really interested where you come from, I guess, philosophically, I suppose. Is it about consent? Is it about permission? Is it about corporate, I guess, not sensibilities, but that corporate drive for more, you know? Mm-hmm. Or is it all of those things?
Yeah, I think it's all those things. And I don't mean that's not a cop-out. The reason that I'm not, you know, I'm trying to be, I'm trying to give the audience credit and to sort of work through that dilemma on their own, because
yeah, sure.
These are, you know, we're sort of living through the moment when we're wrestling with these big questions about what is appropriate. And, you know, so consent is really important here. But the thing is about these big data systems is that the harm that they cause often happens many years down the road. The harm is hard to articulate, right? So so in my case, I posted all these photos of myself, my friends, and my family, and they were used to build a facial recognition system that is now, you know, able to spot a Uyghur Muslim on the streets of Xinjiang and do, you know, and then God knows what happens with that information, right? And I would not have consented to that. I would have said like, hey, you know, I don't want you to do that with my photo. But
right, so I'm okay with you using this to a certain point, but hey, hang on a minute here. This has human rights implications, legal implications, just so much, right? You used a word earlier, Brett, that I find fascinating and interesting is you were celebrating this at one point. That celebration turned to, hang on a minute here. This is just, you're not a moralist, but you said you guys have crossed a line.
But it's impossible to know what that line will be. So the problem with the consent that you described earlier is that how could I possibly give consent to a use that I don't know is possible in the future? And so that's the...
Well, you can time travel though, Brett, can't you?
Well, right, you can't. So you can't time travel. So what you need to do instead, and this is the long way of answering your question, is society needs to, and legislatures and judges and civil society, everybody needs to basically make some bright lines around certain uses that are off limits. And so this has started to happen with facial recognition technology because in large part because, you know, activists of color predominantly have, one of the things that they've pointed out is these systems don't work the same way for people of color as they do for white people. And often that's because the training data sets are, you know, early adopter white dudes like Brett Gaylor. And so that if you build a system like to recognize humans that's based predominantly on white guys, well, then you've just built a system that knows how to see white guys, right? You haven't built a facial recognition.
White guys on their honeymoon, right?
White guys on their honeymoon. And so what you need to do, so we have to have some laws on some guidelines that are basically say these are the uses that we won't allow. So facial recognition, for instance,
right.
Maybe generally as a technology should not be allowed because we might say like society is not in a place where seeing somebody's face and identifying somebody's face has no negative implications. We're not there yet. We know that racism exists. We know that misogyny exists. We know ageism exists. All the things that these technologies are built to spot have negative implications. So you could say go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say. So is there a way? Do you think and you know the cat's out. What do they say? What's out of the bag? Is it
toothpaste?
What's
cats,
that? What's that cliche?
Know. Yeah. Cats
yeah.
Out of
anyway,
bag,
whatever. Can of worms.
Yeah.
Is there a way to dial this back? Jon Stewart, I saw interviewed recently on Colbert, and he was talking about of course COVID and so on, and he went off on a bit of a rant, but he talked a little bit about science. It was pretty funny. He was like, you know, hang on, we gotta talk to these scientists. You know, they just want to know. Like they're just doing this because they can, and mm-hmm. they're not really thinking about those, you know, long-term ethical implications. So I guess that's my question earlier about, you know, is it the computer scientists we need to talk to say, hey guys, you need to be looking out for us here.
Yes. Like, yes.
This is great, right?
But that's not the cat can be shoved back in the toothpaste tube here because we have that. We know, for instance, that you're not allowed to test medicine on humans. You know, you can't just like sprinkle a virus on somebody and say like, oh, does this, you know, is this going to give them cancer or whatever? So because, you know, at some point in the dark ages, people were doing that. And then people said, whoa, stop scientists that we don't want that. And we have laws around nuclear non-proliferation. We have things that you are allowed to do with cars and not to do with cars. We have, you know, the certain rights of privacy and all those things. And what's happening now is those are beginning to intersect with our capacity to build technology. So in the realm of the internet, and this is sort of what the Internet of Everything was about, it used to be considered this sort of external technology. We thought of it in much the same way that we would think about, you know, television or what We're realizing now that it is something that changes the dynamics of society in a more fundamental way. And the sort of information technology has these sort of special characteristics where they can, they can influence an election. They can completely change the norms around privacy. They can do all these things. And so we need to be able to say, here are some useful guidelines for you, computer scientist, when you are developing technology. And so we are starting to see that, with like the general protection regulation in Europe. There's lots of things you can't do now that you used to be able to do. Like when I was making Do Not Track, for example, there's things that you can't do when you collect data. There's consent that you have to proactively get. There's a lot more scrutiny and sort of public pressure around digital rights. Facial recognition, I think, is still something that folks are less familiar with. But having said that, many of us encounter it quite regularly, whether we're aware of it or not. So, as was the case.
Well, look at the homepage of CBC, and I'm sure it's elsewhere. Your favorite news page, wherever you read your updates. But this idea that it's not illegal to show these videos that apparently some of these Russian websites are taking of images of people around the world showing video. So it's not illegal to do that. So it sounds to me like, wow, we got a long way to go. I mean, the implications are for, I got to say a little shout out, by the way, folks, the film's Discriminator, discriminator.film. You got to check it out. It's 15 minutes long. It's fun. It's disturbing. By the way, Brett, it reminded me a ton of Darren Aronofsky's film Pi. Love to chat about that with you as well. But this idea that there's a sequence in your film where you use some animation to show the different companies that had access to your photos, your honeymoon photos, your photos of your kids and so on. That's really disturbing to me that you just go, well, hang on a minute here. We've crossed more than one line.
Yeah. And I think, you used the word creepy earlier, and that's oftentimes people use that word when they describe, a use of their image or their data that they didn't imagine was going to happen. And so when you look into sort of the literature around privacy, what you find is that when people are disturbed, it's because the context in which they shared something has moved to a different context. So, in my case, I shared these photos because I wanted my friends and family to be able to access them, or maybe some artist or other podcast, person to be able to do some creative work with. I didn't anticipate that they would be used by a new audience, so like computer science researchers, right, and in a different sort of mechanism, which was this, artificial intelligence analyzing them, or like, a military contractor China or Russia. Yeah. I wasn't on my radar. Right. And so
I didn't know my honeymoon photos were going to be used to design missiles. I had no idea.
What? Right. And so again, that would have been impossible for me to know. And so that's a really hard sort of philosophical thing to get your head around. And you mentioned before, like, oh yeah, that, it's weird that your photos were used by by all these companies. Well, we're sort of all kind of become used to that and cynical about that, right? Like, oh, of course, Google and Facebook know everything about me because I give it to them.
We've taken a kind of a whatever approach.
Yeah, but then there's moments where it still feels, that C word, it still feels creepy. And that's because it's like when data sort of jumps these lines, it jumps these contexts. And so that's something that you can for sure legislate around, right? It's like, what did this person give consent to? And then there's the other thing, which is like just sort of laws around unlawful use of technology. And that's more like what's the potential harm that can be caused by this? And so in the case of facial recognition, there's this long history of, you know, that goes back to sort of eugenics and the way that, you know, the intersection of, you know, the face and race and being able to sort of quantify a human in that way. Because, you know, race is actually a social construct, right? We are not, that's not a real thing, that we're like different species than, you know, based on what we would sort of quote unquote call race. That's been invented. And usually when it's invented for the purpose of, you know, setting up one of those races as superior to the other one. And so anytime that there's a technology that's sort of codifying that and making that something that just automatically happens when a, you know, a camera and an algorithm and a piece of software looks at a human, that should have a lot of eyes on it. And it should, maybe it shouldn't even exist, right? In the same way that, like, if, you know, David, if you were like, hey, I just invented these X-ray goggles, it's amazing. You can put them on, you can walk down the street and you can see, you know, people without their clothes on. Like, there's no way that you'd be able to bring that to market, right? Because it would come up against, you know, our norms and probably laws around people's rights to privacy of their body. And because we can think of all kinds of reasons why that's not a good thing. You know, imagine somebody using those glasses to look at your kids. You know, we don't have that sort of same set of, you know, understanding and sort of clear rejection of a technology when it comes to a lot of digital technology because of that thing that I keep repeating, which is that the harm often happens in the future. It's like way down the line and a thing that we couldn't predict. So how do you deal with that in the digital realm? And that's kind of what I'm trying to play with.
Well, it makes, you know, Brett, by the way, I think you should be teaching a philosophy of media studies or it's, you know, codified technology. Again, we got to chat about Chomsky here in a second. But by the way, I used to collect comics and I'm old enough to know that, and maybe you are too, but in the back page, you could send like $1.25 away and get things. Those X-ray glasses did exist at one time, Brett.
they existed in our childhood realities.
That's right. Do you remember those ads? Those crazy. I actually remember ordering sea monkeys and some magic tricks, you know? In fact, I probably have some of those comics downstairs. Anyway, no, for sure, right? And I think what it made me think of is, you know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, because we're talking about human rights here. And, you know, when we start talking about things like sexism and racism and the timing of your film, I think it's just so prescient and necessary. I mean, it's not only is it a conversation we need to have, we need to be acting practically about it. It's almost like we need to sort of rise up against this to some degree. You know, I mean, Brett, I downloaded a meditation software recently, and I think I had to give access to this thing to my photos.
Yeah.
Like, what's going on? Like, where does it stop? You know, where does this end? Anyway, back to the UN. Do we need a declaration, you know, of technological human rights to start sort of making these foundational statements and building, you know, sort of from the ground up? Does that even make sense? I mean, maybe that's crazy talk, but it sounds to me like it's sort of moving in that direction.
Well, I mean, we do. The UN does have a universal right to privacy. I mean, that is. Has already been stated and countries have agreed to it. Again, it's like, how do you then interpret that within a modern 100%, context?
Because right? By the way, you gave me access to use your honeymoon photos. Didn't you know? Right. So you waived your rights to privacy. Right. But to your point,
exactly. It's like the, you know, informed.
What's your last line in the film? Something about we never saw that coming.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's about these YouTube, Google essentially trained this AI called DeepMind, which it acquired some years ago. It used the whole kind of corpus of YouTube videos, which is, you know, a lot of videos, to be able to recognize human movement. So now Google has the capacity to recognize when you were, you know, dancing or beatboxing or clapping or, you know, dodging or whatever, you know, like the entire panoply of things that we can do with our body. And that's a, it's another example of like, well, what could go wrong? A lot, you know, like, what if there was a deployment of a technology that was trained to look for somebody that was, you know, quote unquote, suspicious, right? And what, and then what if that was, you know, sold and put into a doorbell camera that you put on your front door,
right? And, doorbell cameras. I'm seeing more and more of them all the time.
Right. And then, so imagine that you're, oh, what a great product. You know, it sort of senses if there's somebody that looks like they're not supposed to be there, and maybe they've got a, you know, they got a hoodie on, and they're, you know, they're skulking around my porch, and then
they're wearing an AC/DC t-shirt,
and it automatically calls the police. Well, that's a that scenario is a real one that you know a young black man might, you know, just get the cops show up, and that is a situation that could escalate. All because he just, you know, he's delivering a package, or he's, you know, or a newspaper, or he's just in the neighborhood, and this sort of quote unquote, like, oh, they're not supposed to be there. Maybe because that database was trained on people that were predominantly white or looked a certain way. And then, you know, the AI extrapolates that this person is outside of that system. And so that's why we use the word discriminator, because that's what AI systems are. They're systems of discrimination. They say it like this, but not this, this, but not this. And it does that a million times a second, and figures out, it figures out what something is by proving that it's what it isn't. Right. And
Brett, one of the opening lines in the film, sorry to cut you off there, but one of the opening lines in the film, you know, you said, my photo trained computers how to see. And I think, isn't that what you're talking about? I mean, from a discriminatory perspective, isn't that where we're really starting to talk about how scary the potential for this is? Or do the apologists for tech and AI say, hang on, we're getting better. We're going to be able to do this, 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 and this eventually.
Yeah, I mean, I think that somebody might say that your photo also trained a computer how to detect, you know, child pornography and or to look for missing persons, or to, you know, be able to detect skin cancer when it comes up.
Right.
Those are uses, but then that's back to this question of, you know, how do we set up guidelines for appropriate uses of this technology and not?
And what did I actually agree to?
Think of it like nuclear power. Okay. Nuclear power has, you know, atomic, you know, production, can make terrible things happen. But right now humanity has decided that there are certain uses where we feel that the benefits are outweigh the drawbacks, and we will regulate it very highly. Like, you and me are not allowed to sort of set up a nuclear power plant. It's not allowed. You have to have a whole bunch of checks and balances to do that. Nuclear weapons are, you know, we're not supposed to make them at all. We have these international non-proliferation treaties. And so I'm not comparing facial recognition to nuclear technology, to, you know, nuclear arms, but I am actually, because we need to sort of set up uses that we think are pro-social, and think about ways where we would adjudicate that, who would need to be looking at that. And people are realizing that anything that has an automated decision-making system should be thought of like that. And so you're starting to see that, you know, the federal government in Canada does have, you know, for any, it's early here, I can't remember the word for when a government procurement, anytime that the federal government uses an AI system that has an automated decision-making, you have to show them how the algorithm works. You have to show them how that data, what was the data behind it? What could go wrong? You have to think those things through.
Right.
And so I think you will start to see that in different jurisdictions.
There's so much trust involved here, right? I mean, I think that's just evident on so many levels. Hey, by the way, so you're not okay with owning a proton pack, having an unlicensed nuclear accelerator on your back? Is that what you're saying?
Back in the early 2000s, I was all about it, but now I've realized that there's some drawbacks.
Right. Right. Well, you know, sadly, Brett, we're gonna wrap up in a couple of minutes here. And I mean, I don't want to oversimplify, and that's always the challenge when you have a short conversation about such a significant issue. And I love the way you've dealt with it. And again, congratulations on the film. It's Discriminator, discriminator.film. You got to check it out. Tell Brett, as we kind of wrap up here, so it's a bit of a digital mess we find ourselves in to some degree. There's pros, there's so many cons. How do you stop from, you know, overreacting, I suppose, and see those pros and what can you do? I mean, you talk about on the website, you talk about stop. I'd love to hear a little bit about that too, maybe as we wrap up this surveillance, what is it? Surveillance Technology Oversight Project. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm looking for a few takeaways here for some of the listeners for, you know, on face to face, but can you talk about that a bit?
I think it's really tempting to want to have a one thing that we can do,
right,
to either protect ourselves or to stop this from happening. And I think it's similar to sort of a climate change scenario where these are systemic, mm-hmm, problems, and so they need sort of, you know, system change in order to see them happen. So yes, for sure, you should. That's why I made Discriminator in a way that Discriminator actually shows you, it activates your webcam and you'll see how these facial recognition systems work so that you can sort of be informed about that. But the solution to it does need to happen in legislatures and in courtrooms and around boardrooms and also in academia. We need to change, those systems need to be changed. And the only way that they are changed is when we have pressure from, you know, mm-hmm, an informed public, but also sort of civil society actors. So there's the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, and they operate in New York and in the US in sort of overseeing this surveillance technology. So what are the appropriate uses of, you know, body cams by police or facial recognition systems on the street or online? We need, you know, it's like the proliferation of groups that look out for the welfare of animals or the climate or the environment, all that. We need that in this space. So we need the Electronic Frontier Foundations and the Mozillas and the Open Medias here in Canada to sort of be pressuring legislators to, so that they know how this impacts us as citizens, so that they can create laws that sort of give the appropriate boundaries for companies and for folks that are developing this technology. It's about these are your bright lines, okay? Because in absence of that, there is going to be a lot of experimentation, and there is going to be a lot of folks trying to, you know, build that proton pack, and then we just lost Winnipeg. That's too bad, you know.
Yeah, that's right. That was what John Stewart's sort of point was. You know, the last thing the world is gonna hear from a scientist is it worked, and then exactly. you know, that's so funny.
Well, that's what happened here too, right? Like there was a contest, literally a contest held to see who could build the most accurate planetary scale facial recognition system. It worked. And now then they put these technologies on the streets of Moscow. And now if you are, test positive for COVID-19 and you step outside of your apartment building, you get a knock on your door from the police without even, just automatically from your face. And that you and I might think, well, that's great because I don't want to catch COVID, but it doesn't take too much imagination to think, well, what happens if I don't, agree with the government that's in power? Or what if I'm, considered somebody that's a suspect just because of the way that I look? What if I'm a recent, what if I'm recent immigrant, a Muslim man that's a refugee in Canada? Am I going to be, looked at with greater scrutiny? And then what are the snowball consequences of that scrutiny that we couldn't have anticipated when we, uploaded that stupid honeymoon photo to Flickr?
Well, so what I love is you're talking about dystopic science fiction, really, in a sense, but hang on a minute. A lot of it's arrived. right? You're talking about HAL in 2001 Blade Runner, Alfonso Cuarón's Children of Men. Like, the implications are deeply troubling.
Yeah, I mean, science fiction, right, you know, is always about the present, right? It's about extrapolations. And I think that, you know, that scene in Minority Report when the advertising system sees your face, right, and tries, like, that, yes, does exist. And that, you know, that some of that was built using my honeymoon photos, I think Estee Lauder and another, this one called Advertima that were built using this. So that, you know, the Gibson quote, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. And I think that the internet is sort of spreading those futures around to all, sure, of us. Well, we're sort of starting to feel that.
Yeah. Back to your comment about ubiquity. And listen, I've just had a blast today, Brett. I'm hoping everyone gets to see your film. I really loved it. I love how it's interactive. It's fun. It's interesting. It's disturbing. It's everything you want in a good documentary, it seems to me. And again, congratulations. So just to be clear for folks, it's discriminator.film. You can find out more about Brett and his work, brettgaylor.com. And Brett, help me out here. It's imposturemedia.com, correct?
Yeah, that's a production company that has a couple links to other films that I mentioned, like Do Not Track and Internet of Everything.
Amazing. Thanks so much for joining us here today on Face to Face. Really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll be chatting again soon.
Thanks, David.